I'm Ray Moss, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Thank you, Butch, for staying with me up here. Need some support. I always like big men around me, wherever I was. Let me take a couple of minutes and thank the people who are responsible for Betty and I being here. We were here in 1989 and had a wonderful time, and a lot of people have left this world since then, and a lot of new people are here. And I want to thank Jerry and the committee and everybody that was responsible for that invitation that came to us, and we're grateful to you for that. I want to thank you for the beautiful water pitcher. See, I know what to put in mine. And beautiful pitcher. And we have one that you gave us 13 years ago, and it's been in a prominent place in our home ever since. And we'll find a very prominent place for this one, too. So thank you for your hospitality. You know, this is a program of miracles, and I have with me today my wife, Betty. That Al-Anon worked a miracle in this lady's life 22 years ago. And I'd like for her to stand, and you folks welcome my lovely wife. I'll try to tell you a little more about her as we go along. Charles said to me, just as I started to get up here, how long is your talk? Well, you know, that kind of set me back. I wasn't sure, you know. Just depends on what mood I'm in and what mood you're in. We may cut it short. And then he said, the disc are 80 minutes. And I thought, well, that's about right. Thank you, Charles, for telling me exactly how long I got to go. I learned a long, long time ago that I don't have to put a watch on my talk. I learned it from a preacher friend of mine I knew a long time ago, and he told me that how he did it, and he said that there was an old boy in his church who came up to him every Sunday. The preacher got through at 12:05, and they were out of that meeting and down to Shoney's before the Baptists got there. And he said he asked him one day, this little boy came up and said, Reverend, how do you do that? How do you always time it just right? Oh, he said, that's a simple thing. So, you know, I learned it in seminary, and I had a class on timing your sermons. He said, when I start, I put a cough drop in my mouth, and whenever that cough drop dissolves, I quit. And it's usually about right. A few weeks after that, the old boy went over 12:05 and 12:10 and got to about 12:30. People started getting up to leave, and he realized that something had happened. And the same old boy came up after and said, Reverend, what in the name of God happened that you went over so fast? He said, you know, I put a damn button in my mouth by mistake. I'll assure you that it's cough drop, not 80 minutes. Where are those folks from Maryville? Right over here. You know, that's the liveliest group of people I've been with in a long time. You know, they were so, we were on a bus together yesterday looking around and having a wonderful time, and they personify what Alcoholics Anonymous is, the fellowship of it. They just helped us laugh a lot, and we just had a wonderful time. I want to thank you for that. That got me started on the weekend, and thank you very much. Good group of people. Little town of Kannapolis, North Carolina, about 20 miles above Charlotte, is where I was born, 1930. It was the home of Cannon Mills, the largest producer of textile products in the world, and I lived there for about 22 years. My mom and daddy were textile workers, my granddaddy was, and they didn't call them textile workers in those days, they called them lint heads, you know. Now, if you don't know anything about cotton mill, but when people would come out of the mill, they'd have cotton all over their hair, and they looked like cotton heads. Lint heads. I didn't like that. I did not want to be a textile worker, and I did not want to be a lint head, and it seemed to me that's the route I was headed in. little house I grew up in was owned by the person who owned the mill. He owned all the houses there, and the people that lived in the houses worked for him, and if you quit working for him, you had to leave. So Mom and Daddy were locked in. They had to live there, and they had to work there. And so, you know, I was old enough to realize that it just didn't seem right to me, but I didn't like it. In that little mill house, there were three rooms and no bath, and I learned everything I needed to know about life in that little house. I learned all about the anatomy of the body. You just can't hide in a three-room house when you're trying to do anything. So I knew everything about it before I ever got into health classes in school. I learned how to drink in that little house because my dad was the alcoholic. Well, that's not what Mama called him. Mama called him a damned old drunk. And that's what I thought about my daddy for so long, because he was the drinker in that family. And when he drank, all problems began to take place, and we had a terrible time in that family. If you've ever lived in it, and many of you have, if not all of you, you know what I'm talking about. But I learned so much from my dad. He taught me how to drink. I want to tell you how he drank, because then you'll know how I drank. In that little three-room house, Mama, who was the strong person in that family, she controlled the family. She told us all what to do, and especially him. And he was a little weaselly little fella, and Mama would speak with authority, and Dad would do what Mama said do. And he couldn't drink in the house. It was just amazing. She wouldn't let him drink. But he had a little drinking place off the kitchen, little pantry, about 3x5, if it were that big. It's where Mama kept all her meal and her flour and the sugar and spices and stuff she put together great meals with. Well, I think Dad thought that was his lounge, and that's where he drank. On the right-hand corner of that little lounge was where he kept his jar, and he had it in a bag. And Dad would get, Mama said he's getting mean as hell, but really what was happening to him, and I know it now, he was getting restless and irritable and discontent. He was a periodic drinker. When he'd get that way, we'd kind of stay out of his way, and he'd begin to take that journey into the little pantry. And he'd shut the door, and I'd hear him turn down the bag, and it would rustle around, and then he'd strip off the lid on that little jar. You know, a fruit jar with whiskey in it sounds different than a fruit jar with anything else in it. And he'd turn the fruit jar lid, and he'd turn that jug up or that bottle up or jar, and he'd take him a drink. My dad sang a little song every time he took a drink, and it went like this. Whew, God Almighty, that's good. And about three drinks into that pantry, he'd forget to shut the door. And so that's the way I learned to drink. I watched him, and it was a miracle to me. You see, Mama would tell him what to do, and he'd do it. But when he had about three drinks, he began to tell her what to do. You know, he'd want to dance with her, and he'd want to make love to her, and she wouldn't have anything to do with that. And after a little while, they'd get mad at each other, and Dad would be gone. He'd take off, and Mom might not see him for two or three weeks, sometimes longer than that. I never did worry too much about where he was. He always came back. But what got in this little man's mind was, what in the name of God happened to him when he went in there as a wheezy little fella into that pantry and took that drink and came out? A miracle changed in his life. And so that began to intrigue this little boy. And somewhere along 12, 13 years old, I made a decision one day when wasn't nobody home but me to do what he did. And I went into the pantry and I shut the door. Nobody there. Sets a pattern for my drinking. You'll follow it. I screwed off the lid and took me a drink and sang that little song that Dad sang. And in a little while, I don't know how long it was. It wasn't long. The miracle happened to me that happened to him. I became the man of the house. I became what I wanted to be, and things began to look okay to me. And when I had a drink, it didn't bother me that my dad was an alcoholic, and I really didn't matter that Mamie was a mouth. You know, it just didn't make any difference. And I didn't mind living in Kannapolis when I had a drink. Everything was different that day, and I did what most of you do when you took that first drink. I identified that with something that I wanted to always be a part of my life, and I intended for it to be. So at about 13, I started drinking. And alcohol became the best friend I ever had, I thought. And about age 16, I was drinking so much and not getting to school on time and not being what I ought to be in school, that the principal said to me one day when I turned 16, he said, I don't think he knew what expelled was. He didn't, I don't believe they even knew the word. But he had me in his office one day, and he looked at me and said, Ray, why don't you just quit school? And you know, I thought, that's a great idea. And I did. I just stopped school and did exactly what people in my hometown do if you don't have anything else to do. You go to work in a cotton mill. And I did that. And I did exactly what I said I wasn't going to ever do. I hated my daddy. I want to tell you that from the very beginning. I hated that man. Because in that little family that I grew up in, it was hell when he drank. And I hated Mama because she was involved in that kind of activity. Her mouth began, as soon as he opened the bottle, her mouth began to come open also. I prayed for my daddy for a lot of years. I prayed. He went off to the Second World War, was in the Navy for about 2 years, a little over, and I prayed for him every day. I prayed that he'd die. I didn't want him to come back. I literally prayed for him every day for 2 years that he'd get killed and wouldn't come back to that home, because when he was gone, there was just a little bit of peace in that family. But he didn't die. He came back, started the same old mess. So my relationship to God ended at about 14 or 15, and I didn't pray anymore for a long time. I met my wife in a downtown Kannapolis. She didn't like me to tell you this, but it's the God's truth. She and I picked each other up. I was downtown looking for a woman, and she was downtown looking for a man, and we ran into each other that night. Pretty close to that, and I've been trailing her ever since, and we've been married 53 years. Isn't that amazing? Wonderful experience. The last 22 have been our greatest years. Well, when Betty and I got married, we were going to do exactly what every couple did in the 40s. We were going to raise us a family, get us a little house, and have a wonderful time with life. And I drank an awful lot before I met Betty, but I still drank, but I couldn't drink like I wanted to because Betty was like my mother. You know, isn't it amazing that we marry those people that are so much like them? And she didn't like me to drink, and I didn't drink around her, so when I wasn't with her, I drank, and when I was with her, I didn't. But alcohol was still a part of my life. Something happened to me about age 22. God spoke to me in a different way. I'd never heard him before, but God spoke to me, and I had what you Baptists will call, I had a conversion experience. In other words, I was saved. You know what I'm talking about. If you're Episcopalian, you might not quite understand that terminology, but my life was altered. Total life was life changed. Everything was different. I quit doing a lot of things. I quit quit smoking. I quit quit drinking. I almost quit looking at women. My whole life changed, and Betty and I began to be, her life was the same. She and I become members of a church, became a part of that fellowship, and our lives were different. And not long after that, I had a call to the Christian ministry. I had a call to preach, if you know what I'm talking about. I couldn't escape it. I couldn't get away from the fact that God wanted me to be a preacher. And I wanted to take my Bible and go uptown to Annapolis and preach on the street corner. And I thought that's what I wanted to do. But the minister I knew in my church said, I don't think that's what God wants you to do. I think God has plans for you, and it requires going back to school. Well, that was not in my plans, but that got to be God's plans. And so I started back at age 24 to high school and finished high school, and then went on to college and finished college, and went on to graduate school and finished graduate school. My total life was different. I was a good man. The Methodist Church, and I'm a Methodist, appointed me as a student pastor, and I served those student churches and did a good job. And I was going to school down at Duke, driving 50 miles each way, had two big old rural churches and a whole lot of members, and a lot of them were dying, and a lot of them were getting married, and a lot of problems in those churches. And first thing I knew, I couldn't sleep. And I'm playing golf one day with a young doctor on the golf course in Asheboro, North Carolina, and I made that comment to him, "Doctor, I'm not able to sleep." And he said, "Well, you know, I can fix that." So I went by his office, and he graciously gave me a prescription, and it was a prescription for a sleeping pill. I'd never taken any of those things in my life. But I got them filled, and I took them back home, and I don't know how long I took them, but I took them for a while, and they did the trick for me. They were prescribed to take one a night, and I did that, and after a while, the tolerance level built up. Now, I know what tolerance is. I used to get drunk when I was 14 years old on a long neck Atlantic ale. One beer make me drunk. And in the end, it took a quart a day just to maintain. So I know what tolerance is. Now, my tolerance level built up, and I couldn't make, God, I just couldn't make 30 pills last 30 days when I was taking two of them a night. It just wouldn't work out. So I got the brilliant idea that I ought to go back and see the doctor, and I did. I went down to see him, and I explained my situation to him. I told him exactly what I thought happened. I said to him, "Doctor, Betty threw that bottle away." And I started doing something that day that I hadn't done in a lot of years. I told a lie, and I put the blame on somebody else, and I did that for a lot of years to come. Now, I had two prescriptions, one doctor, and two drugstores, and I began to play that and played it for a long time. I had a hard time buying liquor after I started drinking again. You know, preachers just don't have the leisure to buy it as most of you do. And it took me a long time. I need to tell you how hard it was for me to get something to drink. I'd have to go to an ABC store in North Carolina. That's what we call them. And I have to go and sit in a little strip mall. Now, you just can't go where there's nothing but an ABC store, because people are going to know you're there to buy liquor. So I had to go where there was an Advance store, a little Sears outlet, or a clothing store of some sort, maybe four or five little stores, and I'd park right down the street, and I'd watch that store. Everybody was out of it, I'd run in it. I'd buy mine and get out. I spent more time buying the stuff than I did drinking it. But anyway, that was a part of my drinking life, buying it. It didn't take long doing that one night Betty said, with her mouth about my drinking, I said to her something that I didn't mean, but it was something that I had to say to her. I said to her, "Betty, I don't love you anymore." It's hard for somebody to love you when you tell them that you don't love them anymore. And it wasn't that I didn't love her, it was that she was getting in my way of my drinking, and I wanted to drink like I damn well wanted to drink. You know how that was when I tell her that. And my drinking was just like it started out. It was in a closet, hid up, nobody around. The door was closed, just me. But I wanted to drink like I wanted to drink without somebody mouthing at me. Well, that led eventually to Betty and I separating. We just didn't get along well. Didn't mix well with that my desire to drink. So what I did, and leaving that family. And I left them. I walked away from that family to make a choice. I made a choice to drink. to drink like I wanted to drink. I left that family. Now let me tell you two important things I did. I got me a swinging singles apartment. I'd been married all my life. I got married when I was 18. I'd been a preacher most of my life, and I hadn't been able to swing any, and I really wanted to do some swinging. So I got me a nice apartment over in Greensboro, North Carolina, where we were living, and Betty was on the other side of town. And then the next thing I did, I wanted a bar. I never had a bar. Methodist parsonage are not equipped with bars. And I wanted a bar, and I went to the store and bought me one. It was a nice one. It was imitation oak, but it was still nice, and it had a little imitation leather on it, but it was still nice. Two bar stools and a nice bar, and I put it in that swinging singles apartment. Betty had let me have an old chair, and that's all I had, a bar and a chair. And I had a mattress on the floor upstairs where I was going to do all my swinging, and that's the way I was. And the best of my remembrance, I never took a drink from that bar. Drank like this, up about 15 steps into the bedroom, step over the mattress to the closet, where in the corner of the closet was a bag with a bottle in it. Carry the glass up, pour it out, take it back down, sit down in the chair. When that was gone, back up the steps. I never took a drink, never invited anybody there, and certainly the God never did any swinging. So you see where my life was. And I didn't stay there long because the cost was too high and there wasn't any rewards coming in to me. But I made a decision to move, and I moved on the other side of town. When I finally came to after this move, realized where I was in a senior citizens complex. I'm about 40 years old, maybe a little older than 40, 42, and I've moved into a duplex with all old people around me. All of them are old. Nobody was talking to me in those days. You know, if you've ever been there, you've called people. I called people all over North Carolina, and they got tired of talking with me. And I'd call people out in South Carolina, and they were tired. And I'd call out west, and nobody wanted to talk. And everybody I knew was hanging up on me. I'm sitting there one night in that loneliness that only an alcoholic knows, the deep depression of loneliness, and nobody will talk, and the booze not working anymore, and you just need somebody to tell it to you so badly. And a thought came to me, I believe I can get somebody down here. So I loaded up a double barrel shotgun, buckshot, walked out in front of that little apartment, and I shot the windows out. Stay with me now. I'm in my right mind this morning, but I'm going to tell you where I was at one time. I shot the windows out of that little apartment. I ran in the house and hid the gun and crawled in the bed and fell out on the floor. Picked up the telephone, called the police, and said to them, "Somebody's shooting at me." Wasn't but just a couple of minutes that the squad cars rolled up and the lights were flashing, and I thought. You know, that'll sober you up real quick. And I thought, what in the name of God have I done? Well, you have to hide it now. You've got a story going. So they came in after they looked around, and they questioned me, and I began to tell them what happened. I heard a car drive up, you know, and I heard the door open, and then the shots went off, and that's about all I remember. And they stayed for a while, and then they started to leave, and I walked them to the door, and when I got to the door, I had succeeded in doing what I had planned to do, and about 25 little old men and women stand out in front of that little apartment. They were all scared to death. They came in the house, and we talked the rest of the night, you know, and the next night they came down, and some of them brought their bottle, and we sat around and drank, and successful as I was in doing that, those little people kept coming for about 3 months. The last time the patrolman came to the sheriff's department, he said to me as he started out the door, he said, "You know, Reverend, if I were you, I'd leave that man's wife alone." And there's no involvement there, but just a bad situation. I was working for the state of North Carolina on a special appointment from the church, and It was a political appointment, and in North Carolina, politics change about every 4 or 5 years, and they were about to change, and I knew I was going to lose my job, so I decided that the best thing for me to do is maybe get me another church where I was more comfortable in what I was doing. So I lived in Greensboro, and Charlotte's about 100 miles, and I had called the bishop. I'd written him a letter. Now, the bishop in the Methodist Church appoints ministers to churches, and I wrote the bishop a letter and told him what I wanted to do. I wanted to go back to the country in a couple of little churches. Well, he gave me an appointment, or he gave me an appointment to see him, and so I drove down to Charlotte of Greensboro. I had a fifth with me, and I drank about half of it on the way down there. Now, nobody going to see, no preacher's going to see the bishop without a drink, so I drove down and stepped into his office, and God, I knew I was in trouble when I walked in the door, because on his desk were my records, and they were thicker than the big book, and I knew I was in trouble. Sat down in that man's office, and he said, asked me what I was there for, and I told him. Wanted a couple little churches out in the country where I could put my life back together. And he said, Ray, aren't you divorced? Betty and I had gotten a divorce by that time. And I was real proud of that fact. It was probably the only Methodist minister in our conference that had a divorce. And I kind of swelled up with pride and said, I am bishop. And he said, well, I've never given a preacher an appointment that's divorced. Now, we think pretty quickly on our feet. So I said to him, Bishop, I'm about to be married. And best I know, wasn't a soul talking to me, and Betty wasn't talking to me. And so the bishop said, Ray, who are you going to marry? And I said, Bishop, Betty and I are going to be remarried. He liked Betty. And he said, Ray, if you can do that, I'll give you an appointment. Well, I've got 100 miles to drive and a half a fifth of liquor to drink. And by the time I got back to Greensboro, I know it wasn't that night, but it wasn't long after that I called Betty. Now, for some ungodly reason, she talked to me that night, and I invited her out to dinner, and she accepted. And one night, we were out together, and the lights were low, the candles were lit, and I'm about half drunk. I said to this woman, who was free from me. She had papers to say that we were divorced and she didn't belong to me anymore and I didn't belong to her. I said to her, looked her straight in those beautiful little eyes, and I said to her, Betty, will you remarry me? I want to tell you how crazy you were when y'all were Al-Anon, before y'all were Al-Anon. That old woman looked at me and said, I will. And we got married. My children stood up for me, my daughter and son, and got my superintendent to marry me. I wanted the bishop to get the story, and he did, and he gave me a couple little churches out near the lake. You couldn't get any better than that. And I went there in June, and didn't drink till September. Didn't ever intend to drink again. My son was back with me, and I was remarried to Betty. Everything's going well. I'm doing good work in those three little churches, and the people like me, and I like them. And my Presbyterian friend, I never drank with Methodists, but my Presbyterian friend down the street said, Labor Day of 1979, I think it was, he said to me on that Sunday prior to that Monday, he said, Ray, do you drink? No, this was 1977, I guess. He said, Ray, do you drink? And I said, Richard, once in a while I take a drink. And the next day we went down to that party and they carried me home. And for the next 3 years, I never took a sober drink, breath. I did things in those churches that took me a long time to make amends for. I preached every Sunday drunk, because I had to have it, and I had one church that had the divided chancel. Now, if you know what that is, the pulpit's over here and there's a lectern over there. Well, you start out over there and you're supposed to wind up over here. and I would start out over there and almost not make it over here where I was supposed to preach. But you know, the people came out those doors and they'd say, a good sermon today, Reverend. And that helped me understand that people don't pay much attention to what preachers say anyway. I baptized people I didn't even know got baptized. I buried folks that I had no idea died. And I married young couples that I didn't know got married because I was operating oftentimes in blackouts. But you know, the end comes. And I had to make amends for that, and I hope to tell you about it. But the end of that came to me. I had to run to the very end of the rope. I was having an extremely difficult time trying to adjust my life to what I ought to be doing. And Betty had about adjusted as long as she could, and she had gone again. One morning I came to my senses, and I thought I was to my senses. I called a doctor that I'd been seeing, a psychiatrist I'd been seeing for 10 years. You know, I spent a lot of money on psychiatrists, an enormous amount of money. I never told him the truth. But that morning I called him, and I said to him, Doctor, I'm drinking too much, and I've got to have some help. And he said, well, why don't you come over to the hospital, and I'll help you. Well, he had had me three times, and he hadn't done any good with me before. But anyway, I went. Now, I showed up at that hospital drunk. You know, who's going to go to a psychiatric hospital sober? And so I got drunk on the way over there, and they poured me in. But the next morning, let me tell you, the next morning when I woke up, you know, there's a distinct difference between an alcoholic and a crazy person. You know, someone who got mental disease, a mental illness, is different from us. And I looked at that crowd, and I knew if I weren't careful, they'd get me in that group, and they'd identify me. And I tried awfully hard not to be like them. And I began to do everything I was supposed to do, and everything that I thought they wanted me to do. And they don't know what to do with a drunk. Come in, you're crazy as a loon, and a couple of days when you detox, you're a brilliant person. You know, you're on your feet, you're doing good things. They had no idea. Well, the doctor said, Ray, you're doing so good, we're gonna give you a pass. Now that meant I could go out and come back when I wanted to, but I had to show up and be there at night. And he said, now don't get in any trouble. I'll go to a movie. Well, as soon as I hit the streets, you know where I went to the lounge, got me something to drink, then I got me a couple of bottles to bring back in there. I'm drinking more liquor and more alcohol in the psychiatric hospital there than I could have outside, and it was wintertime and it was warm in there, and I'm having a good time. It snowed real big in that February, 1980, and cars couldn't get in, cars couldn't get out. And there was about 14 little adolescents down the low end of the hall. They had the little adolescent unit there for small kids, 15 to 18, I guess. And I drifted down there, and those kids liked me. They thought I was a cool old dude, you know. They really liked me, and I liked them. So I said to the nurses that morning, if you would get me some pots, I'll take the kids out in the parking lot, we'll get some snow and make snow cream. They had never heard of that, they were so young, but they thought it would be very therapeutic. Since I was on the staff, they gave me the pots, and I ventured out down the elevator with those 14 little kids, and we got out there, and I lost them. I couldn't find them anywhere. I rambled around. I finally saw them. They were sitting over in the corner by the building in a little circle, and they were passing around something or another, and smoking it. So they got me right in the middle, and every time they'd take a tote, they'd give it to me. And first thing you knew, we were all flying up about the 12th story, you know. Now, I tell you that story only because it was in those moments that I had an opening of my mind. A moment of truth came to me. Trying to round those kids up and get them on the elevator was an enormous task, but when I got them on there, going back to the 12th story, I thought, Ray, you're a fool. You are wasting your time, everybody else's money, and everybody's time, and it's time for you to do something. So when we got up to this 12th story, those kids had more sense than I did. They went running off to their room. They crawled into bed and pulled up the covers. Well, that's what I ought to have done, but see, I went to the nurse's station, and I announced to them that I've been drinking more alcohol in their hospital and doing something with the kids that I'd never done in my life, and they need to call the doctor. Well, the doctor couldn't get there, but the next day the doctor came. So I sat down in front of that doctor, and that psychiatrist, a brilliant man, and I told him what I'd been doing, and he said, "No, no, Ray, you can't do that in this hospital. I'm the chief of staff." And I blew my breath in his face. I'd already had a shooter, and he discharged me. And I went back home. Somebody came to get me. And I went back home. And went to that big old house, and there wasn't a soul there. Once again, the loneliness set in, and I made a decision the next day to buy everything that I needed, and I would never again be sober. Well, you know, God had already had a plan. I'm sure it started in that elevator when I made that decision that I was needed some help. Betty was still loved me, and a minister friend, the only friend I remember having in those days, by telephone they got together. And they wanted to find somebody that'd do something with Ray. You know, isn't that amazing? They just want to do something with you. It doesn't make any difference. Just do something, get you out of their way. And they thought of an old boy that lived about 50 miles away. Old boy that I used to drink with and run around with, and he and I used to do a lot of trips together, and they called him. They didn't know that Bob was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know it. I didn't even know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. But they called Bob, and they explained to Bob that Ray was drunk, and Ray needed some help. Now, let me tell you what Bob didn't say when he sobers up or when he quits drinking, call me back, and I'll come get him or come and help him. Bob came to a wet drunk. Isn't that a miracle? We don't do that much anymore. We want them to get sober before we go get them. But Bob came to me. Bob sat in that little kitchen of mine, and nobody there but the two of us. And he began to tell me what had happened to him. He had found the program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and his life was straightened out. I remember him telling me that. And then he said some magic words. He wanted me to go with him somewhere, and I didn't really want to go. But then he said the magic words, "I got something to drink in the car." And I crawled in the car with him. And the next morning, I woke up. I'd been pretty sick. Evidently, I'd vomited all over myself in a hospital room. I didn't have a television, didn't have a radio, didn't have a telephone or newspaper. I had no idea where I was. I looked out the window, and all I could see was snow. Didn't know where I was. So I get back into bed, and I'm trying to decide how I'm going to ask the first person that walks in there, "Where am I?" So that they won't know that I don't know where I am. Little girl came in the room, a little nurse, about 22 years old, somewhere in that neighborhood, and dressed in a beautiful white nurse's uniform, stepped over to the bed and looked down at this old drunk and said, "Reverend Moss, when you were my mom and daddy's preacher, you baptized me. I wanted to die." And I said to her, "Honey, where am I?" And she told me. And she said, "The doctor will be here in just a little while." And when the doctor came in, he sat down on the side of the bed, and I knew him. He had delivered our son 19 years prior to that date. He had given me those sleeping pills many years ago. And he sat down on the side of that bed and put his hand in mine and said to me, "Ray, I know how you feel. I'm an alcoholic." And he got me stabilized for a few days and then sent me to a treatment program. I could never say enough about the treatment programs, because if it had not been for them, I'm not sure if I'd be standing here today. But I'll tell you what they did for me. They didn't do any magic. They took me to AA meetings in those vans that have no windows, you know. You don't have any idea where you're going. You ask them, they say, we're going to a meeting. And just going down the road. But this one night, the first meeting they got me to go to, I really didn't want to go. They said, I said, where are we going? They said, we're going to a meeting. I said, yeah, but where? They said, we're going to the Methodist Church down the road here, and I thought, what's the name of it? And they told me I'd preach there, and I was afraid everybody would see me, but you know, there wasn't a soul there that I knew. You know what they did in that program? They introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me a big book. No, they sold me a big book for $3,500. Really, they gave me that book, and they gave me the knowledge that was in it, and I left that place after 42 days. That was when the sicker you were, the longer you stayed, and I stayed as long as they could keep me. Then they discharged me on March 24th, 1980, and I left that place and went to see my superintendent. I was going to go take those churches back, and I'm going to preach Alcoholics Anonymous. I had enough sermons and all of the lectures they gave me in that treatment program, and I could preach for 3 or 4 years on alcoholism. And I walked in that superintendent's office, and I'm 49 years old. And I said to him, or he said to me, Ray, the bishop and I have decided we're going to put you on leave of absence. Now, that's a kind way of saying we don't need you right now. I left there. I had no place to go. I didn't have a house. I had an old piece of a car. I went back down to Kannapolis, which was about 15 miles away, and pulled up in front of my mama's house in that little old mill house, a place I hated so much. Walked in that little room and said to her, Mama, can I stay with you for a little while? And she said, if you don't drink, you can. And I stayed with her. That night, went to my first AA meeting on my own. I want to tell you about that because it's so important to me. So important to me to remember that. I don't ever want to forget those newcomers who came in like me. I want to always know how they felt when they get there. So I try to remember this. I sat in the car. I knew where it was. Knew where the meeting was. And I sat in the car. It was on a cold March night. It must have been 30 degrees outside. And I was sitting in that little car. Sweat was running off my face and down my face and in my hands. I was scared to death. I'd been to AA meetings, but in a group of people from treatment. Now I'm going by myself. And I walked in that door. But before I got there, I said, you know, if they ask me where I'm living, and I got to tell them I'm living with my mama, and I'm 50 years old, I ain't coming back to this place. And if they want to know where my wife is, and I tell them that she's left me, I'll never come back here again. And especially if they ask where you're working, and I have to say, I don't have a job, I'll not come back here. Well, they never asked me a thing. You know, it was months and months before they asked me anything. They told me some things. That night they gave me 16 names on a sheet of notebook paper. Had names and phone numbers. And it, right across the top it said, call. And you know, I didn't believe them. And I called them. Sometimes I'd call them and didn't have a problem. I just wanted to see if they'd talk with me. And sure enough, they did. They talked. They were warm. They were open. And they told me in treatment how to find a sponsor. They said, find somebody that goes to a lot of meetings and find somebody that's got a lot of sobriety. Well, I was afraid to ask who had sobriety, and I was picking out somebody that I thought I might be able to identify with. And the little old fellow sitting over in the corner, he didn't say anything. He just showed up everywhere he went. And I thought, well, he's probably got 30 days or more, and I'll just ask him to be my sponsor. So one night, I got up enough nerve to ask George if he'd help me a little bit, and George said he would. Well, George had 12 years, and he began to show me how to stay in this program and what to do in this program. my life began to change. Be funny thing, you know, a good sponsor probably needs more meetings than you do. At least that's what I told Betty. I said, George must be sick. He wants to go to meetings all the time. He calls me all the time. I don't need to go, but George is calling and coming by. He took me by the hand and walked me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and showed me the way. He didn't tell me how to do it. He just showed me how to do it. And he's been my sponsor ever since. One night, one day, George did say to me, Ray, it's time for you to make amends. There comes that time in your life, you know, when you got to do that. You've got to make amends. You can't work this program without making amends. And I thought I could. I'd made amends to God. I'd made amends to Ray. I thought that's about as far as I could get. But George said, you know, you've got the list. We worked on that. And you just got to start. So I put it all in my pocket one night. And Betty and I were riding to AA meeting. She lived up the street about a mile with her mama. You know, here we are, two 50-year-old people riding to AA meetings, living with our mamas like a bunch of fools. So she wasn't riding too close to me. I picked her up. She sat far over to the right. But anyway, we got to the meeting. And after the meeting, I said to her, Betty, I need to talk to you a few minutes. Now, this woman had been in Al-Anon, and she knew what I needed and what I wanted. She knew I had to make amends. We stopped off at Burger King. You know, you can make your amends anywhere you want to if you're ready. We stopped at Burger King, a little old table about the size of this podium, and I reached in my pocket and got my papers. George said, you got to tell her everything. And reached over and took her by the hand, looked her in the eyes, and said to her, Betty, I need to make amends to you for all the hurt and the harm, pain that I caused you because of my drinking. And this little lady said to me, as she squeezed my hand, Ray, it's okay. You know where she learned that? At the tables of Al-Anon. And she passed it on to me. And it's been something I've been telling people ever since. It's okay. And you know, that's what amends is what you're making your amends all about. It's just making it okay with the world and with the person you're talking to. Oh, Betty and I laugh a lot now. We have across the years about some of those crazy days that we had. And we're grateful that God put us in those places so that we'd be stronger people. Let me tell you about my first birthday. I need to share that. George said you always got to tell about your first birthday. I don't remember my 10th one. I bet you can't remember it either. I can't even remember 15. I, honest to God, can't hardly remember last year. But let me tell you, I can remember that first birthday as if it were yesterday. 365 days, and they were counting them too. And they let me have a birthday. They let me get to speak. I had old Bob Wynn. Bob's dead now, but he was my 12th stepper, the guy that came and got me and kept me and came back many times to see me. I had him to come speak. Must have been 200 people there. And ego was running wild. I thought they all come to see me pick up a chip. And really what they came was to an AA meeting. And let me tell you the important people that were there that night. My wife was there. My children were there. My mother was there. My family was there. Friends were there. Bob told his story, and they gave me a chip. I hurt my son so very much. My daughter was gone from the home, and my drinking was so bad. But my son was just torn up because of that alcoholism. He was a strapping Navy man, a submariner. He was just about 20 years old. I looked for him after that meeting. I couldn't find him in that crowd anywhere. And then it dawned on me that I did exactly to him what my daddy did to me. I told him that men don't hug each other and men don't cry. And he couldn't have stayed in that crowd of people without hugging somebody or crying. He got out of it. I went to the stoop of that little church and looked down across the parking lot. Way down in the corner, I saw him. I stepped off there and started toward him, and he started toward me. And in the middle of that parking lot, that young man put his arms around me, and I put mine around him. The first time since he was a little bitty boy. And this is what he said to me. You're the best daddy in the whole world. You know what I had to do to get there? Come to meetings, don't drink, read the book, work with some other people. And that boy that had, about 2 years prior to that, shook me awake one morning from a drunken stupor and said to me, Daddy, you know what you did last night? And I said, Son, I don't remember. And he said, You slapped Mama. I loaded a gun. I was going to kill you, but Mama wouldn't let me. And in the middle of that parking lot, after 1 year of sobriety, he put his arms around me and said, You're the best daddy in the whole world. Isn't that amazing? Let me tell you about Joe, my dad. The miracles of this program. I'm living in South Carolina with about 5 years sobriety, and old Joe's still drunk. And because he's drunk, I couldn't make amends to him, and I just kind of let him go. And I got a call from him one morning, and he said to me, Son, I'm sick. Well, that's about 125 miles up to his house. I said, I'll be up there in the morning. And so I drove up there and went to his house, and he's living by himself. He's on the couch. He weighs about 90 pounds. He's been drunk for 6 months. He cannot get sober. And he said to me, Dad, he said, Son, I need to see a doctor. And I said, well, I'll go get the doctor and bring him out. He said, No, I got a problem with drinking. Now, he had never told me that. I picked his little butt up and threw him in my car and took him off to the treatment center at the VA hospital and poured him in there, and they kept that man 4 months, and they got him sober. I gave him every chip he picked up. The man I hated so much, the man I wanted to die, that God would kill him, God put him in my life, and he and I became AA buddies, and I gave him every chip he picked up. I was going to take him a 6-year chip, and he died before we could get the meeting to the hospital. And out in the funeral home, I walked up to him in the casket and had his 6-year chip, and I stuck it in his pocket. And I said, Dad, you're cold sober. he would have liked that. Now, if you're hedging, I'm going to play a little hard on you this morning, myself too. If you're hedging on making amends, let me tell you, you got to do them. Man, I didn't want to do them. And I didn't know how to make those amends to all those church people that I had stood up and preached to drunk, or administered the sacrament of the Lord's Supper to drunk, or visited in the hospital drunk. I wanted to just stand up in mass and say, I am sorry for doing that. But I couldn't find any of the ministers who were there would let me do it, you know. So I just didn't know how to do it, so I had to put that on the back burner and just kind of wait on it. And I'm living down in Florida, working in the hospital there, and I read in the Daytona Beach newspaper that the bishop who was my bishop when I was running crazy was now the bishop of Florida. Now, the thought came to me. Now, the bishop in the Methodist church is the head of the church. If I could make my amends to the head of the church, surely the head of the church, too, could forgive me and accept my amends. Well, that was my rationale, anyway, and it wasn't my thinking. It had to be a God thing, so I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back, and he said, you know, Ray, you don't owe me an amends. Now, he misunderstood me, but he did give me an appointment, and I drove over to Lakeland and sat down with that great man of God for about 4 hours, and I did a fifth step with him of all the things that I'd done in the church and to the people in the church that was wrong. And he said to me, I've never heard that kind of honesty in my whole life. Now, here was a bishop in the church who had never heard that kind of honesty. I said, well, Bishop, that's just one of the steps. We got 11 more. I really offered to go through them with him, but he didn't want to accept it. From that moment, it seemed to me that to show me how amends work in this program, from that moment on, things began to unfold that had not been unfolding for me. I had a call from the church that had put me on leave of absence and had been 3 years. And they wanted me to come back to the church and help them help others in the church who had a drinking problem. Clergy and clergy family and church members. And for a long time I've been doing that. I've been doing conferences, regional conferences. I've been sharing in a lot of churches. I tell a lot of people about the program. Work with a lot of families, and did that until retirement for a few years ago. God worked in my life when I was willing to let God into my life fully. And making amends for me was the opening of the door. I was talking with a young man that I worked with a few years ago down at McDonald's. I used to go there every morning and meet a lot of folks. I'd meet some of the construction boys I worked with, sponsored them. They'd come in early because they had to get their work done. They'd come in pretty dirty and sit down. We'd talk a while, and then they'd leave. And insurance representative would come in with his tie on, and he'd stay a while, and we'd talk a little bit about the program, and then he'd leave. And I didn't have anything to do in those days, and I just hung around McDonald's and talked to all the boys I worked with, and they'd come in, you know, different shifts. And I had the book with us. We'd go through the book, some of us, and getting assignments for the day and the responsibilities and who we was going to work with and what we were going to do. And I think they thought that I was evangelizing at McDonald's or selling dope or something or another. We never did tell them what we were doing. But one day Gene came in, and a young guy that I was working with, about 2 years sober. It's been about 8 years ago now. I think Gene's got 8 years, so it's been about 6 years ago. Gene sat down beside of me and across from me in that booth, and we had the book out, looking at the passage and discussing it, and he looked me straight in the eye that morning. And he said to me, "Ray, I want to tell you something." He said, "I want to be like you." Isn't that a terrible responsibility? He wanted to be like me. When I first got here, there wasn't a soul behind me. I was the last man in the door. Nobody wanted to be like me. I was a drunk. I had lost everything in life, including my job, including my family, including everything in the world, and I'd lost the desire to live. And now here's a young man saying to me, "I want to be like you," and what a responsibility that placed upon me. I read this morning again that story from on page 191 when Bill is there with Henrietta and that anonymous member of AA, Bill D., telling his story. Bill D. says, I couldn't figure it out. I just couldn't figure out all the enthusiasm that they were having. And then he said, I heard Bill Wilson say, "Lois, God has done, or Henrietta, God has done so much for me, relieving me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling other people about it. Telling others about it, what he's done for me." I think that's the essence of the story that we're here about today. To tell other people what's happened to us, what took place in our lives. There was a meeting at my home group, not my home group, but a noon meeting on Thursday before I came down here. There were 11 newcomers in that meeting out of about 40 people. 11 new ones. They were all under 20 years old. The door's wide open. Now I can do my part, or I can say to somebody, "You do it for me," but I've got a responsibility if I'm going to carry this program to other people. And that means that I've got to share my life with others. My life is not my own. It ended over 22 years ago. My life did. But God's life is in my life now. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given to me a new life, and what I do today is what I want God's will to be for me, and I want him to give me the power to carry it out, and it's changed so much. What a journey it's been for me. Sometimes I look back on it and I get dizzy myself thinking about what has happened in the last 22 years. First of all, I couldn't find a job when I got sober. Jobs were hard to find. They weren't hiring preachers when I got sober, and I had to go back to work in the cotton mill in Tenapolis and manual labor for $3.65 an hour, and that was degrading, I thought, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It taught me a lot. And then a fellow hired me to work as a counselor in a treatment program. I wasn't even a year sober, and I made a I thought I made a mistake. He didn't think so, but I worked there for a while. Then I came back to Kannapolis, went back to work in the mill. And then he hired me back to be the director of a program down in Florida. So what an enormous responsibility came to me in just a few years of sobriety. God had plans for me, and Betty and I just hung on, and we've just ridden it right out. We went back to Greenville, South Carolina, and I was a director of a program director of the treatment program there in that hospital system for about 10 years, and then we retired. Isn't that amazing? I didn't have anything to call my own, and we were able to retire 9 years ago. It's just a miracle. Well, we retired and moved back to Kannapolis. Now, to top it off, we bought a mill house. Spent a lot of money on it, trying to get it in shape. Betty had to have another bathroom, you know. She just couldn't handle one, so we had to have two, and build a garage and those kind of things. I said, I'm never going to put another tie on except to go talk at an AA meeting. I'm not going to work with people anymore. I'm just set to work with alcoholics, and that's all I'm going to do. And going to build some things. I bought me a bunch of tools, and I started building things. And about a year and a half, I got tired of doing that. I got tired of it, to pull out little nails, put in bigger nails, you know, just tired of doing this. So I looked around and thought, what can I do? I prayed a lot about it, and I didn't want to preach, and God wasn't calling me to do that anyway. I'd done that enough, and so I decided that God wanted me to run for a political office. Yeah, I laughed too when I... Some days I laugh now, you know. And I ran. I ran for city council, and AA boys helped me. We didn't mix AA and politics. We learned how to do that, but they helped me, and I almost got elected. And 2 years later, I ran for mayor, and I was elected. But I want to tell you about that. It's exciting. The program works. It really works. We were over at the country club after the vote had been cast that day, and we were waiting on the results. Oh, there must have been 200 of us, big crowd. Upstairs in the country club, and about 40 or 50 of those people were in the program. We were watching. Oh, they had the computer set up and had screens and all this. We were watching the results, and I'm leading really heavy. Kannapolis is in two counties. I'm leading really heavy in one county. I'm carrying it about 700 votes, and then gets to the other county, and my lead begins to dwindle, and more conservative up there again. So that's what they tell me. So I'm not a politician, I'm a statesman, so I don't know much about that. We watch the results, and they just keep going down and down and down. They get down to about 50, and I thought, well, brother, I'm going to lose this election. And believe it or not, it stopped at 12 and locked right there. Now, those of us in the program looked at each other. 12 votes. And it stayed that way for 2 days until they counted some other votes, and then it went to 10. 12 steps and 10 commandments, and that's where I believe it happened. What a miracle it was. Well, anyway, I took office, and I served for 4 years, and I ran again last year, and it was a landslide. So, you know, I'm doing something right. Now, I tell you that not to brag about it, because it's a tremendously responsible job. Kannapolis is the 19th largest city in North Carolina. It's a big town of 40,000 people, and so I've got a lot of responsibilities. But I practice the principles in all my affairs, and I get to do a lot of things that other people couldn't do. And I've got a lot of experience from the other side of the story, you know, the other side of the page that I bring over to that side. And it's just been a great experience. Let me Let me share with you something about my mama. I don't talk about Mamie much in my story, but for some reason I wanted to tell you about this. Mamie stayed bitter all of her life, to the last part of it. She was bitter about a lot of things. But she came to live with us, and Betty kept her, and Betty and I kept her for a long time. And then we had to get her in the nursing home, and she went to a nursing home there, and within the hospital system that I worked for, and it was a nice place, and she stayed there about 4 years. And one morning they called me, and they said, "Mamie's in trouble." So I drove about 16 miles over to that hospital and got there, and Mamie was not well. Mamie was dying. And I came to her bedside, and Mama and I had gotten real close in those last years, and I put my hand in hers and looked at her, and I said to her, "Looks like it's over now, doesn't it?" And she didn't say anything, and I thought she had lapsed into unconsciousness. And then I squeezed her hand, and I said to her, "I love you, Mama." And the last word she said to me was, "I love you, son." She loved the alcoholic but did not know how to express it. She said, "You can stay with me if you don't drink." That was her only way of believing that she could help you. Just don't drink. But she loved the program. She watched her boy get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She watched miracles take place. And I watched her as she died. And, you know, without the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that would not have been possible for me. Would not have been possible. We have a young grandson who's going to turn 18 this month. We almost never get to see him now. He lives in Connecticut. But he had he's got our genes. There's no doubt about it. He's got our genes. Every Moss that I know is one of us, not in the program, but he's sure an alcoholic. So I've introduced that little boy to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he was a little fella, he'd come to stay with us for a while, and he liked to ride around, you know, and get in my truck, and we'd ride, and we'd talk, and I keep a big book in my truck about the same place I used to keep a fifth. He picked it up one day, and he knows what the program's all about, and he said to me, "Papa, this is a big book, isn't it, of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Yeah, it is, Darrell." I said, "What about turning over there about page 58 and reading a little for me?" And while we drove around, he began to read. Rarely have we seen a person fail, and read right on through the steps. And while he was reading, tears running down my cheek, because this little man that I never see anymore, someday I believe he's going to need this program. And I've introduced him to it. I've opened the doors. He went to San Diego to the convention with us. He knows Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've opened the doors. And I want the doors to stay wide open. To find joy in the program, the joy is in that golden text. God has done so much for me in relieving this disease that I want to tell others about it. And I think that's my responsibility. So that's why I keep doing what I do. That's why I keep going to meetings. That's why I keep working with other people. That's why I keep coming to conventions. That's why I keep talking to people like you, and especially to newcomers who've not yet heard the message. The famous words, the most important words that Bob said to me on the side of that bed was, "Ray, I know how you feel." 5 important words. There's nobody knows how that alcoholic feels like you and I know. I've been there. I know how hard it is to come into that first meeting. I know how hard it is to ask somebody to be your sponsor. I know how hard it is to make your amends with somebody. I know how hard it is to write that inventory. And I know how they feel. It's been a wonderful week with you folks. I get a lot of places and do a lot of things for AA, but coming here has a special meaning. It's just a, it's one of those unique places. Don't ever lose it. Don't ever lose what you got here, Jerry, and the committee. Hold on to it. Hold on to the warmth and the friendship, the fellowship, the joy and the laughter, because that's the language of the heart. And when that happens, when you lose that, you lose what you got. So I hope you never lose it. I want to thank you again for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to be with you this morning.